Hello and welcome back to Exiting the Cave Short Reads. We're working our way through Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, and this week we're working on Chapter 4. In this chapter, philosophy begs a reason for Boethius's lamentations. Boethius, however, decides to make himself the prosecuting attorney instead of offering a defense of his own case. He uses the evidence of his own life as a prosecution against God. There will be more to say about this afterward. So, I will leave you to the reading. Whoso calm, serene, sedate, sets his foot on haughty fate, firm and steadfast, come what will, keeps his mien unconquered still. Him the rage of furious seas tossing high wild menaces, nor the flames of smoky forges that Vesuvius disgorges, nor the bolt that from the sky smites the tower can terrify. Why then shouldst thou feel affright at the tyrant's weakling might? Dread him not, nor fear no harm, thou shalt his rage disarm. But who to hope or fear gives way, lost his bosom's rightful sway, he hath cast away his shield, like a coward fled the field. He hath forged all unaware, fetters his own neck must bear. Dost thou understand, she asks, do my words sink into thy mind, or art thou dull as the ass to the sound of the lyre? Why dost thou weep? Why do tears stream from thy eyes? Speak out, hide it not in thy heart. If thou lookest for the physician's help, thou must needs disclose thy wound. Then I, gathering together what strength I could, began. Is there still need of telling? Is not the cruelty of fortune against me plain enough? Doth not the very aspect of this place move thee? Is this the library, the room which thou hadst chosen as thy constant resort in my home, the place where we so often sat together and held discourse of all things in heaven and earth? Was my garb and mien like this, when I explored with thee nature's hid secrets, and thou didst trace for me with thy wand the courses of the stars, molding the while my character and the whole conduct of my life after the pattern of the celestial order? Is this the recompense of my obedience? Yet thou hast enjoined by Plato's mouth the maxim that states would be happy, either if philosophers ruled them, or if it should so befall that their rulers would turn philosophers. By his mouth likewise, thou didst point out this imperative reason why philosophers should enter public life, to wit, lest, if the reins of government be left to unprincipled and profligate citizens, trouble and destruction should come upon the good. Following these precepts, I have tried to apply, in the business of public administration, the principles which I have learnt from thee in leisured seclusion. Thou art my witness, and the divinity who hath implanted thee in the hearts of the wise, that I brought to my duties no aim but zeal for the public good. For this cause, I have become involved in bitter and irreconcilable feuds, and, as happens inevitably, if a man holds fast to the independence of conscience, I have had to think nothing of giving offense to the powerful in the cause of justice. How often have I encountered and balked Conagastus in his assaults on the fortunes of the weak? How often have I thwarted Trigwilla, steward of the king's household, even when his villainous schemes were as good as accomplished? How often have I risked my position and influence to protect poor wretches from the false charges innumerable with which they were forever being harassed by the greed and license of the barbarians? No one has ever drawn me aside from justice to oppression. When ruin was overtaking the fortunes of the provincials through the combined pressure of private rapine and public taxation, I grieved no less than the sufferers. when at a season of grievous scarcity, a forced sale, disastrous as it was unjustifiable, was proclaimed, and threatened to overwhelm Campania with starvation, I embarked on a struggle with the Praetorian prefect in the public interest. I fought the case at the king's judgment seat, and succeeded in preventing the enforcement of the sale. I rescued the consular Paulinus from the gaping jaws of the court bloodhounds, who, in their covetous hopes, had already made short work of his wealth. To save Albinus, who was of the same exalted rank, from the penalties of a prejudged charge, I exposed myself to the hatred of Cyprian the informer. Thinkest thou I had laid up for myself store of enmities enough? Well, with the rest of my countrymen at any rate, my safety should have been assured, since my love of justice had left me no hope of security at court. Yet who was it brought the charges by which I have been struck down? Why, one of my accusers is Basil, who, after being dismissed from the king's household, was driven by his debts to lodge an information against my name. There is Opilio. There is Gaudentius, men who for many and various offenses the king's sentence had condemned to banishment, and when they declined to obey and sought to save themselves by taking sanctuary, the king, as soon as he heard of it, decreed that, if they did not depart from the city of Ravenna within a prescribed time, they should be branded on the forehead and expelled. What would exceed the rigor of this severity? And yet on the same day, these very men lodged an information against me, and the information was admitted. Just heaven! Had I deserved this by my way of life? Did it make them fit accusers that my condemnation was a foregone conclusion? Has fortune no shame, if not at the accusation of the innocent, at least for the vileness of the accusers? Perhaps thou wonderest what is the sum of the charges laid against me. I wished, they say, to save the Senate. But how? I am accused of hindering an informer from producing evidence to prove the Senate guilty of treason. Tell me then, what is thy counsel, O my mistress? Shall I deny the charge, lest I bring shame on thee? But I did wish it, and I shall never cease to wish it. Shall I admit it? Then the work of thwarting the informer will come to an end. Shall I call the wish for the preservation of that illustrious house a crime? Of a truth, the Senate, by its decrees concerning me, has made it such. But blind folly, though it deceive itself with false names, cannot alter the true merits of things, and, mindful of the precept of Socrates, I do not think it right either to keep the truth concealed or allow falsehood to pass. But this, however it may be, I leave to thy judgment and to the verdict of the discerning. Moreover, lest the course of events and the true facts should be hidden from posterity, I have myself committed to writing an account of the transaction. What need to speak of the forged letters by which an attempt is made to prove that I hoped for the freedom of Rome? Their falsity would have been manifest if I had been allowed to use the confession of the informers themselves, evidence which has in all matters the most convincing force. Why, what hope of freedom is left to us, would there were any? I should have answered with the epigram of Canius when Caligula declared him to have been cognizant of a conspiracy against him. If I had known, he said, thou shouldst never have known. Grief hath not so blunted my perceptions in this matter that I should complain because impious wretches contrive their villainies against the virtuous, but at their achievement of their hopes I do exceedingly marvel. For evil purposes are, perchance, due to the imperfection of human nature, that it should be possible for scoundrels to carry out their worst schemes against the innocent, while God beholdeth, is verily monstrous. For this cause, Not without reason, one of thy disciples asked, If God exists, whence comes evil? Yet whence comes good, if he exists not? However, it might well be that wretches who seek the blood of all honest men and of the whole Senate should wish to destroy me also, whom they saw to be a bulwark of the Senate and all honest men. But did I deserve such a fate from the fathers also? Thou rememberest, methinks, since thou didst ever stand by my side to direct what I should do or say, thou rememberest, I say, how at Verona, when the king, eager for the general destruction, was bent on implicating the whole senatorial order in the charge of treason brought against Albinus, with what indifference to my own peril I maintained the innocence of its members, one and all. Thou knowest that what I say is the truth, and that I have never boasted of my good deeds in the spirit of self-praise. For whenever a man by proclaiming his good deeds receives the recompense of fame, he diminishes in a measure the secret reward of a good conscience. What issues have overtaken my innocence, thou seest? Instead of reaping the rewards of true virtue, I undergo the penalties of a guilt falsely laid to my charge. Nay, more than this, never did an open confession of guilt cause such unanimous severity among the assessors, but that some consideration, either of the mere frailty of human nature, or of fortune's universal instability, availed it to soften the verdict of some few. Had I been accused of a design to fire the temples, to slaughter the priests with impious sword, of plotting the massacre of all honest men, I should yet have been produced in court, and only punished on due confession or conviction. Now, for my too great zeal towards the Senate, I have been condemned to outlawry and death, unheard and undefended, at a distance of near 500 miles away. Oh, my judges, well do ye deserve that no one should hereafter be convicted of a fault like mine. Yet even my very accusers saw how honorable was the charge they brought against me, and, in order to overlay it with some shadow of guilt, they falsely asserted that in the pursuit of my ambition I had stained my conscience with sacrilegious acts. And yet thy spirit, indwelling in me, had driven from the chamber of my soul all lust of earthly success, and with thine eye ever upon me, there could be no place left for sacrilege. For thou didst daily repeat in my ear and instill into my mind the Pythagorean maxim, Follow after God. It was not likely, then, that I should covet the assistance of the vilest spirits when thou wert molding me to such an excellence as should conform me to the likeness of God. Again, the innocency of the inner sanctuary of my home, the company of my friends of the highest probity, a father-in-law revered at once for his pure character and his active beneficence, shield me from the very suspicion of sacrilege. Yet, atrocious as it is, they even draw credence from this charge from thee. I am like to be thought implicated in wickedness on this very account, that I am imbued with thy teachings and established in thy ways. So it is not enough that my devotion to thee should profit me nothing, but thou also must be assailed by reason of the odium which I have incurred. Verily, this is the very crown of my misfortunes, that men's opinions for the most part look not to real merit, but to the event, and only recognize foresight where fortune has crowned the issue with her approval, whereby it comes to pass that reputation is the first of all things to abandon the fortunate. I remember with chagrin how perverse is popular report, how various and discordant men's judgments. This only will I say, that the most crushing of misfortune's burdens is, that as soon as a charge is fastened upon the unhappy, they are believed to have deserved their sufferings. I, for my part, who have been banished from all life's blessings, stripped of my honors, stained in reputation, am punished for well-doing. And now methinks I see the villainous dens of the wicked surging with joy and gladness, all the most recklessly unscrupulous threatening a new crop of lying informations, the good prostrate with terror at my danger, every ruffian incited by impunity to new daring and to success by the profits of audacity, the guiltless not only robbed of their peace of mind, but even of all means of defense. Wherefore, I would fain cry out. All right, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that reading. I have actually four basic things. First, on the verse. Many point to Boethius as a Stoic philosopher and use the arguments in some of the later books to make this case, but I think this first verse in chapter 4 is a good example of how Boethius was synthesizing both Stoic and Aristotelian philosophy. This verse, on my reading, is about how a man's virtue is his own and cannot be taken away by any mortal power. It must be surrendered, and that surrender occurs in the thrall of the powerful. On the other hand, from a Stoic point of view, you could say that hope and fear are emotions driven by a desire to control the powerful. And giving up the belief that this is possible, you can recapture your own power or your own control over your life to the extent that you have any. In any case, the prose offers three different insights from my reading of it, and here they are. First, Lady Philosophy's reference to the ass and the lyre is a subtle callback to the rivalry between Dionysus and Apollo. Dionysus is the symbol of beauty in the sense of the arts, and Apollo is the symbol of truth in the sense of the sciences. In one tale between Apollo and Midas, for example, Midas's ears are transformed into an ass's ears for choosing Marsyas over Apollo in a musical competition. What's more, The Ass and the Harp is a famous Latin poetic tale, making the rounds at the time that Boethius was writing his Consolation. And, interestingly, it's directly relevant to Boethius' complaints about fickle fortune later on. The short tale in English goes a little something like this. An ass saw a lyre lying in a field. He tried the strings tentatively with his hoof. They responded with sounds. A sweet thing, he mused wistfully, but wasted on one like me, who am ignorant of the musician's art. If someone more skillful had stumbled on this, imagine the magic music he could have made. So genius must go often unnoticed and be lost to fame by the fickleness of fortune. Second, it's entertaining to hear Boethius offering us a litany of his own virtues, and then thumping his chest about how he has studiously avoided trumpeting his own virtues, and how you lose some of the value of your virtue when you surrender it to fame, and yet here we are, 1,500 years later, reading all about him. But also, in the next few chapters, this bit of irony will become important because the upcoming chapters make it clear that Boethius was profoundly aware of his own self-pride and his own self-pity. He couldn't have written Philosophy's Lines without being so aware. And so the irony is, on my view, intentional. He wants us to realize that he's aware of his own foolish position. And lastly, note the biblical tone that Boethius takes in this book. The final passages of chapter 4 are clearly meant to evoke the moment of Job begging God for an explanation for his woes. Boethius' own situation is nowhere near as dire as Job's, with the possible exception of Boethius' death sentence. And this seems to me to be more dramatic irony. We'll see more of this invocation of Job in Boethius' prayer in chapter 5, which is coming next week. I hope to see you then.